There are some seats at the front. Good afternoon. Welcome to this session, Why Don't Catastrophe Models Work, or Do They? The speakers will present viewpoints from different angles. The first speaker will be David Lalonde, followed by Maria Kovas, and there will be a period for questions at the end. We would also appreciate if you fill the survey form and drop it to the CAS registration desk after that. David is SVP at AIR Worldwide Corporation. He leads the consulting services group that helps clients run models, analyze and interpret results, and also integrate them into catastrophe risk management programs. Prior to AIR, David worked at Coopers & Lybrand, ICBC, and the Economical Group. He's a graduate from the University of Waterloo, a FCAS, FCIA, MAAA. He's also currently the member of the AAA Extreme Events Committee. Maria, after holding several positions in the systems and financial areas of a commercial property casualty company, she joined another major modeling firm in 1993. There she supported major clients representing leading segments of the property casualty, reinsurance, broker, and financial institutions. Upon leaving RMS, Maria joined the Zurich Financial Services Organization, working as the catastrophe modeling liaison between the US and Swiss offices. She holds a BA and MBA. David, this is your turn now.
Thank you. I went back to my room on the break to get the handouts, and if there's not enough handouts for everybody, they will be available on the website. As I walked back, I had to walk past the pool, and I wondered what I was doing. I'm really surprised to see this many people here. It's beautiful outside. See if we can keep your attention. Good afternoon. Why don't catastrophe models work, or do they? I really don't like the title of this presentation. Of course the models work, you know. Today I'll be talking to you about what models have been telling us, how to use and interpret model results, and what the models do tell us about the future loss potential. The first thing to get straight is that catastrophe models do not cause hurricanes. They don't set rates, and they don't make buildings fall over. Catastrophe models are tools, tools that allow you to evaluate risk within a framework, provide valuable information for effective risk management. There's a lot of information in the models, but you have to run the model to get the information out of it, and you have to run the model again and again. You need to test the sensitivities of the model and understand and interpret properly the results. Catastrophe models are also not designed to give us the losses from a specific event. However, they're designed to assess the probability of different levels of experiencing future potential loss from future potential events. The models work. The agenda for my talk today is to review the 2004 and 2005 hurricane seasons briefly. Then to talk about understanding what does come out of the model. What does the model give you, and does it give you the answer to everything? No, it doesn't. So then I'll talk about how you can look at various ways to start incorporating adjustments for additional sources of loss. And finally, back to exposure data, which is a key driver of catastrophe losses. So let's start with the 2004 hurricane season. Before 2004, we were experiencing a period of low activity. Although we did have Hurricane Floyd, which was coming straight at Florida with loss potential in the billions of dollars. However, when Floyd turned north and just flooded South Carolina, most people breathed a sigh of relief and then forgot about the loss potential that big hurricanes could create. In 2004, there were four landfalling storms impacting Florida, causing over $20 billion of loss. This led to changes in Florida policy conditions, the introduction of the annual deductible. The models were there and appropriately used to model the impact and potential rate changes necessary to incorporate this policy condition change. The models evolve and are always learning lessons. From 2004, we confirmed the presence of demand surge. It's real, and I'll talk a little bit more about it later, but it did lead to changes in the model in terms of incorporating aggregate demand surge functions, which base the amount of demand surge on losses aggregated in time and space. 2004 also confirmed the effectiveness of strict building codes as implemented in Florida. So was 2004 an unusual season? Here we see a table which lays out the probability of multiple hurricanes in a year from the model. This is from the model before 2004. And we see a probability of four or more events happening, making landfall in the US, of about 8%. And the probability of three or more storms making landfall in Florida in a single hurricane season is 2.5%. You get these numbers from running the model. So you see, the models did anticipate storm seasons like 2004. 2005 set a record for the most hurricanes forming in the Gulf and Atlantic Basin. Four landfalling storms, and as we saw, this is not totally unusual. While Hurricane Katrina caused the most loss, Wilma caused nearly $10 billion of loss. I think it's about the third ranked storm in terms of size of loss now. Hurricane Rita and Dennis. Hurricane Katrina tracked through Florida on August 25th as a Category 1 storm. And later on August 29th, Hurricane Rita made landfall in Louisiana as a Category 4 storm. Does this track look familiar to anybody? I'm sorry I don't have it in the presentation here, but if I was to overlay the track of Hurricane Andrew, it looks very similar to what we say here. And actually, the track that Katrina took is not a surprise, and it is incorporated within the modeling. Katrina, however, was an unusually large storm for its intensity. I won't go into the details of the meteorology and how this happened, but it did give us more information in terms of how we view radius of maximum winds in relationship to central pressure. The models have now incorporated this new information. But even before this new information, the models had simulated events the size of Katrina, Katrina-sized losses around New Orleans. What wasn't anticipated in the model from Katrina was the failure of the levee in New Orleans. The models don't calculate damage to infrastructure, never had, never said we did. When you're comparing model performance to actual losses, you need to compare the losses from the storm that are comparable to the losses from the model, compare apples to apples. Additionally, some of the numbers we hear include damage to offshore oil rigs. Again, we don't model damage to offshore model oil rigs. These are both areas of current research. The models do model storm surge, and they do incorporate a fraction of the storm surge into the modeling results on an as-requested basis. But there's a difference between storm surge, which is the difference between storm tide and normal tide height, and it's the water driven by the wind, and it comes up onshore and then recedes, as opposed to the flood, and the flood that resulted from the levees breaking, and the standing water and the associated things that can happen, not just from the flooding claims, but the potential mold and other issues that will be caused by flooding. Let's look at the losses from Hurricane Katrina. In terms of estimated losses, the models estimate the property losses consistent with what the industry losses are. It's understanding what the models are estimating and what the models aren't estimating. In terms of the unestimated flood losses of $43 billion, about $4.5 billion of that will make it into the insured losses and raise that estimate of $34 billion to $38 billion, which I think is our current estimate of losses from Hurricane Katrina. Here we see our exceedance probability curve, which is a common format of looking at model output before the 2005 hurricane season. The probability of loss exceeding various levels of loss, expressed here in return periods. We can see that Katrina's property loss of $38 billion falls with about a 3% probability of exceedance. So in fact, there are many losses even over $100 billion which could be experienced in our simulated catalog of hurricanes. So we do anticipate big events in the models. So we did learn a lot from the last two hurricane seasons, and the model will models will continue to evolve. The science is not static. The models did not fail, however. They were producing results consistent with the last two hurricane seasons. The dollars, however, will continue to grow as the property values and exposures grow over time. Now I want to talk a little bit about how the models work. This slide provides a high-level overview of the components of catastrophe models. What questions do the models answer? What are they useful for? They deal with how big, how often, and how frequent potential events are to occur. We start with something called event generation, and then yield intensity calculation, goes to the damage estimation, and finally an insured loss calculation. So in the first components of the model, event generation, we take a look at all the historical data, and we come up with fits of distributions of the key variables that drive hurricanes, like the central pressure, the radius of maximum winds, the forward speed, track information. And we generate a stochastic simulated catalog of events of potential hurricanes that could happen next season in accordance with their probability. Once this catalog of simulated events is created, we use meteorology-based wind field models to calculate intensity as measured here by wind speed. So what is the wind? And we estimate the complete time profile of the wind speed. So not just what is the wind now, but what is the wind an hour later, what is the wind an hour later, because duration has a significant impact on catastrophe losses as well. So we generate the events, we get the intensity of those events, and then we need to calculate damage. Well, then we turn to the input of the model, which is exposure information, which I'll talk about in more detail, and the insurance or policy terms. When we have the intensity or wind speed acting on a particular building of a particular construction at a particular location, we get resulting damage. And these engineering relationships have been developed over time, validated with actual claims data to give us the vulnerability functions that the models use. And then the final step is to overlay things like deductibles and policy limits and reinsurance terms and conditions to get to the insured losses. The models themselves provide a rich amount of detailed information in terms of the output. They provide event-by-event level information, probability distributions or exceedance probability curves, annual aggregate losses, occurrence losses, which is the maximum loss in a year, large losses, deterministic events, historical events. What if this historical event was to recur? What would its loss be on today's portfolio? You can look at industry losses or company-specific losses. You can use the full distribution of losses that come out of the model to derive any type of risk measure. You can look at standard deviation, you can look at various return periods, you can look at the tail value at risk. All this is standard output of the model. Now let's look at the input for the model. Obviously, the model output and the value of the model depend on the input. For the models to run, we need three basic kinds of information. First, where the exposure is located. Because the location of the exposure impacts what the winds are going to be. How far inland from the coast is that? How much is the hurricane going to degrade before it gets there? What's the local terrain in that environment, and how does that interact with the wind speed? That's why location information is needed. Then we need to know what we're going to damage, and we're going to damage the replacement value of the structure. Not the amount of insurance, but the replacement value of the structure. And this is an important distinction that's made, because the vulnerability functions which underlie the models are based on replacement value, not on insured value. And then third, we need to know building characteristics, because different types of construction react differently to different kinds of, to the wind speed. So we might have wood frame versus masonry, and they have different vulnerability functions. At a minimum, for the model to produce results, we need information at the zip code level, we need the replacement value, and we need the construction information. Now, obviously, the more detailed information you can provide, the more confidence you can have in your result. Most companies now are using street-level data, or geocoding at the street level. When you say that you have street-level address, you can't just assume that now you have good data. You need to look at running the model, geocoding the data, and looking at the results. The models will give you output reports that say, yes, you have street-level address, but only 80% of it was coded at the geocode, and the rest was defaulted to the zip code. You need to understand how the model works. You can't just run the model and use the results blindly. Now, the model also contains a lot of secondary risk characteristics, which modify the risk to wind. We've termed these secondary risk characteristics. These are building features which impact the risk of loss from hurricanes. For example, window protection, like shutters. Whether a building has shutters or not is going to impact whether there's damage or the amount of damage. Each of these characteristics are modification functions. Let's look at some of them. Here are examples of these modification functions. It's important to note that they're not single factors, but are actually functions or curves, which vary with the intensity or wind speed. A good example of why this is important is the fact that something like hurricane shutters provide a lot of protection, you know, when the hurricane first comes in and the winds are, you know, 90, 100 miles an hour and debris starts flying around and hitting the building. Without shutters, the windows are breached and the hurricane pressure differentials will rip the roof off. But when you put shutters on there, they protect it. But when you get up into higher wind speeds and the roof blows off, it doesn't matter if you have shutters or not. And some of these can be additive in terms of their impact on losses, on protecting or mitigating against loss. What we did here was actually take all of those secondary risk characteristics you saw a couple slides ago. And for each of those characteristics, there's various levels. Like, for instance, for shutters, there's no shutters, or there's, you know, standard shutters or engineer's shutters, different levels. Each of these, we took the different levels and we put them in a contrived exposure in a building. We put in each zip code, we ran the model, and we looked at the range of losses. And this is just for a specific zip code, and this is for a particular type of building, a wood frame building on the coast of Florida. And we can see that understanding whether what kind of covering is on the roof, you know, can change the losses from 1 to 8%, -1 to 8%. The shape of the roof has a big impact. Now, this might not be something you can mitigate against, but it's something you want to use in your risk management to understand the loss potential. And likewise, other categories of mitigation characteristics. It's important to also to understand how these characteristics work together. So by simultaneously looking at the best and worst features and running the same risk can yield losses from 26% lower to 54% higher. In this example, a total loss range of 80%. So it's important to know the data that you're putting in, not just the street level address, but other characteristics. If your building is just assuming a default, if you're nothing like the industry, then your results can be off by, you know, a significant amount. So you need to run the model. I like this. The models not only provide answers, but they teach you the questions to ask. You can use the models to understand which policies contribute the most to your large loss potential, what characteristics contribute disproportionately, what geographic areas contribute most to your large loss potential. You know, where are your concentrations, and where are your concentrations in conjunction with areas that are prone to catastrophes? What's the impact of changing underwriting guidelines? Using the model, running it, and seeing the impact of different risk characteristics, and then making underwriting decisions on that basis to say, you know, relative to, you know, these two types of categories, this buildings with shutters provide better protection, or they provide better protection on the coast than they do inland. And these things can lead to underwriting guidelines. They can be used to evaluate risk transfer alternatives and answer a multitude of other questions. So if you got your exposure data right, then you get and run the model and you get your loss exceedance curve, your loss distribution. It provides a robust starting point for catastrophe risk management and for assessing relative risk. But that's not the end. You haven't accounted for all the risk. The models produce losses to onshore properties, to buildings, appurtenant structures or outbuildings, contents, additional living expense, and direct business interruption. They don't provide losses to everything. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things we don't account for directly in the model and how you might adjust for that. First thing I want to address is, you may have heard the phrase before, what is implicitly modeled? When you look at what the model results are, you'll say, well, is debris removal included? And you'll hear the answer, oh, that's implicitly included. What that means is that the damage functions that are underlying the models are based on engineering. And the engineering will say, this wind speed acting on this type of building causes this much damage. And it doesn't have anything to do with debris removal. However, over time, there's been a lot of claims data come in, and the models are validated against claim data. And when a client sends loss data, and we see, here's the data from the loss, here's the exposure, here's the damage ratio, we don't know what's in, we haven't separated out the losses from debris removal, tree damage, etc. So over time, all these losses are implicitly included in the model loss results. But for mega catastrophes like Katrina, the types of losses and the hazardous waste and things like that are not necessarily included in the modeling. And so even though it may be implicitly modeled, it's not inappropriate to adjust losses further for to account for these other factors. There are models that account for additional sources of losses, such as demand surge, storm surge, and industry loss assessments. Demand surge functions have developed that, based on the size of an industry loss, you can adjust your ground-up losses to account for temporary post-event inflation. Separate storm surge models are developed, which account for losses from storm surge. These models have been used to estimate the amount of surge loss, but not the amount of flood loss. And in terms of standard ways of viewing things, some companies will assume that 10% of those surge losses are kind of indistinguishable for wind and seep into your wind losses. Also, on the commercial side, you can adjust the percentage or the take-up rate of the losses, of the coverage, rather. Finally, underlying the model is an industry exposure database, and we can very easily estimate industry losses. And once you have estimates of industry losses, you can apply assessment formulas to determine any potential loss assessments from various state funds, etc. Demand surge is caused by delays in repair, delays caused by infrastructure damage, delays in building permit processes, shortage of building inspectors, extended exposure to elements, temporary fixes. Everyone's got to go and throw a blue tarp on the roof first, and there's a cost of doing that that's beyond the cost of then going back and fixing the claim. Potential building code upgrades, bringing workers in from out of the area and having them pay them per diem rates, increased loss payments just due to stress and work overload. These are all things that are real costs to insurance companies post-event. The demand surge is real. It's not just price gouging. I know there's a lot of that's been done in the last little while to address things in terms of having hotlines to address, you know, price gouging and things like that. But even absence that kind of traditional thought of demand surge as being price gouging, there's real sources of additional loss outside of that are happening, that no matter what government controls are put in place to mitigate against price gouging, will lead to increased losses. The point I want to make about demand surge also is that demand surge issues should not be confused with insurance to value issues. There's a lot of underinsurance issues in the industry, And people will say, well, my claims are higher than I thought, so it must be demand surge. It's not always demand surge. You need to, you know, look at the replacement value issues and why losses are being higher. And is it caused by economic factors, or is it caused by the fact that you were underinsured? Next is storm surge. We have a separate total model which estimates losses to storm surge. It takes account of bathymetry and how the waves come on shore. And you can see that there's a lot of different potential areas. New Orleans is not the only area that is subject to storm surge. And you need to know this, and when you run the model, include storm surge, because these losses are real. Now let's look at some things that we don't model. The models do not include loss adjustment expenses, and the data that we get from client companies to validate the models does not include loss adjustment expenses. Indirect business interruption, which is business interruption where there's no physical loss to the building, but there may be power outages or damage to suppliers or something that cause you business interruption. Inland flooding, damage to offshore property, whether it's boats and yachts or oil rigs, hazardous waste cleanups. You can look to experience from past events to provide guidance to be used to adjust your model losses for these other factors, but it's very dependent on the unique nature of the event. Loss adjustment expenses. For instance, you may have a program where you can estimate what the amount of loss adjustment expense is going to be relative to the size of the industry loss or even the size of your company loss. You can adjust it by adding it incrementally to demand surge. And it's very easy within the models to go in and make a loss adjustment expense modification to the demand surge function, which will lead to the ability to run the model, including a factor for loss adjustment expenses. Indirect BI, you know, Hurricane Charlie was coming in towards Tampa, and if it hadn't made a turn and had hit Tampa directly, with the power sources there being underground, it could have caused significant surge and flooding, and power could have been out for 6 months. We would have had very significant indirect BI, aside from the direct BI costs. Again, you might say, okay, well, there's not going to be a lot of indirect BI for small catastrophes, but once you get over $20 billion, we can assess maybe there's 3% indirect BI, and when you reach $30 billion, it's going to be 4%. You can just create a stepwise function. Anything that you can relate to an industry loss, you can build in and easily calculate the impact on your risk profile from catastrophes. Damage to offshore properties. Obviously, if you know that you have insurance on oil rigs, you need to know where they are. Are they in harm's way? You need to be able to make adjustments to your model results or know whether your model includes these or not. The same thing goes for marina exposure, boats, yachts, pleasure craft. Hazardous waste. Not just whether you're insuring hazardous waste facilities, but also where your exposures are located relative to them. And the models can help. The models have terrorism landmark databases, and included in those are all the hazardous waste sites throughout the country. So you can go in and, you know, do concentration studies and look at how much of your exposure is within harm's way if there was an earthquake or a hurricane to come in and destroy a hazardous waste facility or a chemical plant, etc. So the models are giving you information. They're not giving you the answer, but they're giving you the ability to play and find out what the answers are, how the losses could be impacted. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about exposure data. In the 2004 and 2005 storm season gave us a lot of exposure data, a lot of claims data with which to review the performance of the model. But we need to look at the data itself and make sure that it's reasonable. And we found a lot of information in terms of exposure data. You know, we having claims from outside the wind field. We look at where there's no wind, there's still claims coming in. And so maybe it's just a standard claim. They got coded with a catastrophe because it happened on the same day. We look at policies and you do a reasonability check, because the real thing happens when client will say, your estimates of losses didn't come close to what my actuals were, and if this happens, why did it happen? So you look at their exposure data and you look at their claims data and you find areas where there's a big discrepancy. And you may look at a commercial building and see a mismatch in the losses, but then you also go in and you say, okay, this is the replacement value of the building, $10 million. This is the square footage, and that implies a cost per square foot of $10. Well, if that reasonability check is done before it gets to the modeling aspect, we obviously know that that's not, there's issues with the data. We've done a lot of claims audit and found these types of things are happening a lot. Another common example would be somebody writing $5 million X of 10 on a policy and entering $5 million as the replacement value when it's really a $25 million building. It's very important to know that the values you're inputting into the model depends on them being replacement values, and you need to make sure that they are. Now I want to touch a little bit on the fact that, yeah, the loss potential seems to be growing and growing every year. The models are changing, the science is evolving, they're not always getting worse, but one of the things that is happening is the exposures are growing. In terms of the growth in the last 10 years, you know, pictures of what used to be forests are now subdivisions. Coastal beaches are now full of properties, and we can see growth rates are averaging 30% in coastal regions over the last 10 years. The new homes as well are getting larger. What people are building are not like the typical existing building stock. You see 70% growth in the size of homes in, you know, Long Island area, and you can see the rest here. The new homes are also architecturally much more complex. Yesterday, this is a typical home style, and this is the home styles that we're seeing built today. Well, you got to remember, it's going to cost a lot more to replace and repair that building than it did from, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Even the interior aspect, when you took a look at the cost of replacing this kitchen to make it like it is, you know, it might be $10,000. And to take today's kitchens and spend $60,000, $70,000 to replace the, you know, the marble countertops and the high-end appliances and everything, the cost of replacing buildings is going up. We can look here, this graph, which shows the average change in residential cost per square foot across the country, and see phenomenal growth in the last 10 years. It also varies by region of the country, depending on the demographics, whether your buildings are in wealthy neighborhoods, are there any accessibility issues, local ordinances that are all going to impact and modify the replacement value of the homes. So we can see here that over the last 10 years, aside from any model influences, the risk from catastrophe has doubled in terms of the potential losses, and it's doubled. This is based solely on exposure growth. And the next 10 years, it's going to double again, and we're going to see, you know, $100 billion losses, you know, with a 1 or 2% probability of occurrence. So in terms of, you know, just the numbers and inflation, things are getting bigger. The loss potential is very high. These aren't the biggest losses, but we increasingly, you know, in all areas of the country are seeing large loss potential, and this over $50 billion of loss may happen. Long Island, Florida, the Gulf, Texas, and New Madrid and California. I haven't talked a lot about earthquake today, but it's just as significant an issue. In fact, we've already had a lot of big events that have happened in the past 100 years. The issue is that the exposures that are there today were not there when these events happened. This graph shows the potential losses that would happen if these historic events in the last 100 years were to recur today against today's exposures and policy conditions. And you can see the 1906 storm, I think it is, caused significant losses. 1926. And if any of these storms had happened with slightly different parameters, the results could be even more devastating. So, to conclude, I want to say that it's not the failure of catastrophe models, but the failure of risk management that has led the last two seasons to be viewed as a surprise by the insurance industry. The users of the model must utilize the results with care and with caution. Know the strengths and weaknesses of the models you use and the science and engineering upon which they rely. And don't harp too much about what the model did and didn't do well in past events. I know this is an important issue and a necessary step in validating the models and providing credibility to the models. But instead, today I urge you to focus on what the models are telling us about the future loss potential. Run the model, examine the results, test the sensitivities. The models are tools that provide great and valuable information and plenty of data for actuaries to play with. Now, Maria.
Putting the water there because this is my computer. Oops. Good afternoon. Just for my own curiosity, how many folks actually work hands-on with the models today in this room? Maybe 10%. How many work with the output? Another 20%. Interesting. Interesting how the rest of you are all in here. There's a beach out there, people. I also had a gut reaction to the title of this presentation. When Ben mentioned it to me, the first thing I said was, you know how many times I've written that presentation in my head? And as I went through my notes and I went through the information I had collected, I realized that I'd written a litany of what the models didn't do. And since I'd come from the modeling environment, I thought perhaps today's presentation would probably be best serving you all if we talked about what the role of modeling had been during the quiet years, the original role of modeling in the presentations that I made. And actually, there's somebody in the audience who's seen me make the presentations when I was at RMS, so I'm being held to the fire here. Changes in the expectation over time and a return to the basics, which is something that, even though David and I work completely independently, we're kind of going to the same place. So what happened during the quiet years? Well, the modelers rose in the early 1990s, driven forward by events like Hurricane Andrew and the Northridge event. In the following years, it got quiet. So we had lead events during the year, Hurricane Floyd with its flooding in New Jersey and the Carolinas, Hortense here in Puerto Rico. And we talked about the reason the models didn't keep up was that it was a rain event, or the hurricane stalled, or Northridge was an unmapped fault. And of course, every modeler got the question, well, how do I map an unmapped fault? And the answer is, if you know what your exposure is, what does it matter? So as we go forward today, we'll talk about that process. It also began to take a role in the day-to-day operation of most insurance companies. So things that were exceptions now became routine. So once or twice a year, you ran your enterprise-wide model, and you did your reinsurance pricing. And you passed that around, you came back and you bought your capacity, and you were fine. David mentioned underwriting guidelines, and it was the development of underwriting guidelines for things like attachment points, deductibles, ways to move your book around so that you can optimize it. We talked about primary pricing in the beginning of adding factors for cat loads, a standardized method for doing this. The alphabet accounting for business planning, ROE, ROI, RBC, all of a sudden it's like television CSI and all that other stuff. We have standardized ways of addressing those issues. But ultimately, where we expected the models to come through for us is post-event loss evaluation. We expected to have a number. My first day at work at RMS, I was in a training class with a new client. I had just met my new boss. We had not entered the data, and it was the day of Northridge. And the senior vice president who had signed the contract came running in and said, "What's the number?" So there's no data in the system. His team is just getting trained, and somewhere along the line, he had in his mind decided as soon as I signed the contract, there was this number that would be developed by the models. And it's this leap that we have to come back from and start working for. So what was the original role of the models? Well, it was a diagnostic device. In effect, it was designed to go through and determine things like the distribution of your exposure, what David mentioned in terms of postal codes and street level data. It was identification of high density areas, the Tri-County area, New York, Houston, the offshore areas. Areas that had key adjacency issues. If you recall the lore from Hurricane Andrew, the Homestead area was devastated because several insurance companies, in an effort to support our business, our servicemen, had gone through and opened up their books and written all their homes. And there's a lot of lore that goes along with this. For example, when I first started, there were maps on the wall with push pins. Can you imagine trying to do push pin aggregation maps for McDonald's, Home Depot, some of these large retail chains? Between the consolidation of the various marketplaces and industries, and our industry consolidations as well, it's almost impossible to be able to go through and come up with a standard way of doing this. And finally, the issue of consideration of redistribution of exposure. And this is what David was talking about in terms of running optimization studies, running the models frequently, and learning your data very well. Identification of drivers of risk was another key diagnostic role for the models. The point was to determine if the 80-20 rule applied, and if you had key accounts that drove your modeling and PML forward, if your risk distribution was your problem, if you had occupancy, age, construction, and height issues, which are the four issues or four secondary primary building characteristics that David was mentioning, application of secondary peril information. Was there surge involved? Was there fire following? Was there sprinkler leakage? What was modeled? What was not modeled? How did you put all these pieces together to come up with an automated driver risk evaluation? Consideration of the data quality. The inclusion of new sublimits has occurred in many of the models. You can now get a sublimit for fire following. You can get a sublimit for tiers. You can get a sublimit for secondary perils. All of that is now available in some of the models, but do we have the data to be able to enter it? Identification of more building characteristics, a set of secondaries that David had identified, and a cost-benefit analysis of modifying the systems to update the data. That's an issue for us. A lot of our interfaces are older. They go through our financial or premium systems, not necessarily through the handheld or field systems that are used to evaluate these buildings. Now, what happens if prospectively, as David demonstrated, we have these huge loss exposures and our models are still picking address, height, occupancy, and so on? Is that a reasonable use of the models? The metrics, another basic role of the models originally. Determination of business and underwriting goals. It was a phrase that I used to hear all the time called our risk appetite, being able to satisfy our risk appetite. Lately, that's been toned down a little bit for a variety of reasons, I assume. Review the current position of the organization, making sure that your risk mix is what it should be. And chart the differences between the goals that you have and where your model actually takes you, and try to bridge those gaps. Periodic review and updates of the movement in this process is very important. Pretty much every modeler at some point has put up some flavor of the underwriting cycle. Set your underwriting goals, implement them, evaluate them. There's also on occasion a second ring that puts your reinsurance goals in there, a third ring that puts your business goals in there, but at the end of the day, the point is that this process is dynamic. It needs to be constantly revisited. You can't just go through it once and walk away from it. catastrophic response. It's not possible to plan for a catastrophe. We try to mitigate it with financial tools. We try to mitigate our exposure by running the model and coming up with our correct risk distribution. But at the end of the day, you can't plan for the levees to fail, or you can't plan for a Cat 4 storm to swing in right up into New Orleans. The best thing you can do is prepare. One way of preparing is to evaluate the event curves. And what we mean by that is to go through and identify the curves to determine if you have the possibility of clustering in your book of business, or if you have key events around your key return periods that also have a very high probability. So you may have one event in your 250-year cycle that has a $100,000-year return period, but you may have another event that has a 1,000-year return period. Now, which one do you model for your event drill? And that's the next piece of information I'd suggest you try, which are event drills. Event drills are basically going through and running key events, whether they're simulations of historic events, new events, or events that cluster around your key return periods, and determining how you would deploy your claims team. How would you go forward and resolve issues about various, I'm trying to say the settlement teams, and I guess I'm thinking claim adjusters and so on. How would you get those folks out there? What is your worst case scenario? Who are your key accounts? Do you need to contact them and determine that you've properly inspected their facilities and so on? There are a lot of different ways of addressing the client-business relationship using an event drill and preparing management for this information. Factors that contributed the change in expectations. Well, first we began to blend the idea of peril modeling and total losses. Over time, and let me just keep going through this, there are also second-generation modelers. There was a quiet period where there were singular events and there were data issues. There were also updates to the methodologies. Peril modeling versus total losses. Models are based on specific perils: shake, fire following, sprinkler leakage, business interruption, not contingent BI. Review of actual events to calibrate the model outputs. And here what happened over time is that since we did not have a series of events, then we had to go through and actually use the historic events to recalibrate and review models. Sadly, in order to recalibrate a model, we have to have a serious event. Quiet periods limited those events. Actual losses are based on all affected perils. In an ideal world, you could run the model and have a composite result for your sprinkler leakage, fire following, shake, and know what that number should be. Otherwise, you're burning wet rubble. Second generation modelers. When I started this, and it's been a while, I dealt with vice presidents, senior vice presidents, and spent a lot of time in their offices going through and installing the software. Over time, however, things have changed. These people have moved ahead, moved on, and we have a second team of professional modelers. These are people who were recruited for their professional skills. Now, the issue here is, if you're trying to communicate information to senior management, well, the first team was senior management. They were the ones making the business decisions. They were the ones that had the voice that was heard by the CEO or the president. The second team that's come in these days are very bright people, very talented people, but their job is to run the model. So during the quiet period, the model became the sole focus of losses. Hang on, let me catch up myself here. Events occurred, but at a slower rate. The model results could be evaluated, causes of differences could be identified, and we moved on. So for example, in the case of Hurricane Floyd, it never quite made landfall. When it did make landfall, it was a flood event. Or Hortense here in Puerto Rico, it was a rain event. Or Edmund that stayed off the coast of the Carolinas, causing sand and beach erosion, was a beach event. We became comfortable with this information, and we became comfortable with it because it was a tolerable, maybe a tolerated variance. We knew what the differences were, and we dealt with them. However, the models are now capable of refinement with additional data points, and this is the structure that David was talking about. We need to be able to capture this information, and the question is, can we? It may not be updated because we don't have the budget to do this. We may not have the systems to do it. But at the end of the day, can we go forward and not do the data capture? I don't know. The valuation issue is another key point. David mentioned the fact that we may think when we renewed a business, it was $100 million. And the reality is when we go through and evaluate it and use the business tools that are available to evaluate locations, it's $150 million. And how do we bridge that gap? What information can we use? Finally, new financial structures. These are in reinsurance, these are in policies, and so on. Many financial structures and accounts that are not personal lines are tiered. So I will have one blanket limit or one limit for New York, another one for the Virginia, Carolina area, one for Florida, and one for Texas. How do I get that in the model if I'm only putting one account in? Now, the models have the ability to start capturing that, but now do we have interfaces to do it? I don't know. Updates to the methodology. Well, as we go through when we review the methodologies, and I've been to pretty much every client conference for the three major modelers for the past 3 years, I'm hearing terms like paleoseismology and the USGS seismological evaluation of the 1906 California quake. And I'm learning that people are going back through and using the current science to evaluate the historic events and try to apply that to the current information. It's helping. It's closing the gap. Some of the modelers actually changed the methodology to try to assist in evaluation of the new science. And finally, they recalibrate the models to go through and identify new vulnerabilities as they learn things. In Northridge, we thought reinforced concrete was a great earthquake-resistive device until we found out that all the joints in the cast rebar had cracked from the intensity of the event, and the buildings were being corrected 3 and 4 years after the event. So perhaps we should consider reestablishing the role of modeling. Well, reestablishing the role of modeling takes into account four issues. Model data as currency, return to the basics, ensemble reporting, and setting expectations. Model data as a currency. Model data as a currency allows us to begin to evaluate business units within an organization against each other on a common standard. So if you're modeling or if you're using the data, it takes all the different variations of systems data from your systems and puts them into one formatted database. Doesn't matter which model you're using. You can still get that data coin out and use it well. It also allows the reinsurers to evaluate you on a common plate. So the models aren't going anywhere because they, in fact, provide common ground. And like a currency, the more confidence you have in the data that you're being supplied, the better rate information you're going to offer. So in effect, we have a data coin. I have my data. I will share it with you. It looks the same as everybody else's data. You have to make sure that you're comfortable with it, and I'm hoping that I get the best rate from the reinsurers. So in returning to basics, we're talking about returning to the underwriting cycle, returning to the review of reporting provided to management, recreating the event drills that we did years ago. Refresh the training of your modelers. Make sure they understand not only the modeling process, but the business process they're working within. And update the data capture and the interfaces. In terms of ensemble reporting, we need to create multiple views of exposure, not just a PML. We need to be able to look at a database or a file and make sure that we understand the drivers, the PML influences, the distribution of the data by zones, the rates, the brokers and producers that are in it. We need to be able to understand what is available in the models and not just go through and assume that because we have the number, that's what we're going to be working with. Evaluate the secondary perils, make sure you don't have gaps, and use mapping. I mean, some of the most effective work that we just saw was David pictures and maps, the two houses, keeping in mind that each layer of mapping can offer a different perspective now with a new mapping software. And finally, I'm going to bring out that old chestnut, communicate. Anticipate the questions, consider the key issues in your firm, review your diagnosis, and determine if the remedies are cost effective.
Thank you, Maria.
No hard questions.
No hard questions.
David is nudging the questions. We'll wait for his comeback.